three things that we look at now that I think any limited partner should be looking at is the terms of the debt and the leverage of the debt. And what are those triggers inside that debt clause? Because at the end of the day, when we've been buying a lot of land, we're doing it all cash. At the end of the day, all cash, they can't take it away. As long as you pay your taxes and your insurance, you typically can weather the storm for the most part, right? But going into deals today, you really got to understand the debt terms and what are the triggers that arise if something goes sideways.
That was John Cohen. He's one of the founders of Turo Real Estate Partners. In today's episode, we really get into what happens when a deal goes sideways. What's your obligation or what should you do as a limited partner, as an investor? So stay tuned. This is a really good episode.
The limited partner shares in the potentially outsized returns of a well-planned and executed investment, but as a passive investor, and has the maximum leverage on their most precious asset, their time. And that is why we're here together. 90% of the millionaires out there built their net worth with real estate. However, 0% of the billionaires are hands-on managing the real estate assets because there simply isn't enough time. My name is Jake Wiley, and for the past 16 years, I've been investing in real estate, and I've learned a thing or two. But the most important lesson is how to leverage the expertise and time of others to maximize your investment potential. Welcome to the Limited Partner Podcast.
All right. Welcome, partners. We're back again for another episode in the tumultuous times that is 2023. This week, I'm joined by John Cohen. So he's with Turo Real Estate Partners. John, welcome to the show.
Jake, thank you for having me. Hopefully I can provide some good value for your listeners.
Yeah, and this episode is going to be a little bit of a shout out to Nate Reed, who wrote in asking, what do you do in this current environment where maybe you've already stopped receiving distributions as a limited partner and now you're thinking that the world is coming towards capital calls? So Nate, thank you. And for those of you who are out there that have questions, I actually do listen and we do actually record shows about these topics. And I think this is going to be a great one. So, John, we're going to get into that. But first, for my listeners out there that don't know you and don't know Turo, I'd love for you to give us a little bit of background about yourself.
Yeah, so a little bit about us. We started 10 plus years ago, really focused on value-add multifamily, like a lot of people out there. Our bread and butter ended up being some super heavy lifting multifamily projects, 100% vacant properties, 50% occupied, a lot of deferred maintenance, you name it, every problem a property could possibly have. And that's really what we ended up falling in love with and executing really well. Throughout this, the last 10 years, obviously the market has been extremely in our favor. So we were able to really take advantage of not only market conditions, but also really buying a really good basis and a really good property. That's been our bread and butter. Probably, mid-COVID, when it became a little bit harder to travel and operate, we started buying a lot of land, and now we're probably 65% multifamily focused. The other 35% is probably somewhere on, the vacant land subdivision development side. But that's really, the high-level snapshot of what we've done over the last 10 plus years.
Yeah, I think that's super helpful, too, because I actually get a little bit concerned in this day and age when, somebody's like, hey, we've been multifamily, we're going to stick with it, and it's perfect. It's still awesome. Starting to, seeing folks just diversify out from like one asset class, especially one that really, ran up during kind of COVID, especially with the way cap rates and the market was going, multifamily became really interesting. And for a long time, I was attending conferences and reading the tea leaves of the economic conditions, and this is even before the interest rates started changing. I was like, are we really thinking about what's coming in the future? And there's a lot of people out there that just seem like they were, everything is great. Like now is the time. But I think where we are now, the Fed's raised interest rates. We're actually starting to see some significant multifamily defaults, right? I think maybe just last week or the week before, there's a $350 million default in Texas. And that's just kind of the one of many that's out there. John, I guess to start the conversation before we get into the nuances of the actual investing and Chase putting good money after bad, possibly, what's your take on the market? Where do you think we are? What do you think it looks like? And then maybe even get into a little bit of a discussion about your diversification strategy.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I think from the 30,000 view, I still think the fundamentals are extremely strong for housing. There's a demand for housing, rental housing more so because interest rates in the last 6 months have gone crazy. So people need a place to live. So there's still a shortage of housing. So I'm still on the side of pro housing. But the biggest caveat there is pricing. We've excelled in, opportunistic deals on really good bases. That sort of disappeared during COVID. So I don't want to say we were net sellers, but, we went from, 4,500 apartments, I think, down to, sub 1,000. And three properties probably selling this year, and then we wouldn't be left with a handful more. So I am pro-housing, but I was talking to a very good friend of mine the other day, and he said, what are you doing right now? And I said, honestly, if I'm not walking into a deal with a strong cash flow, I'm not even going to offer on it, because I can't buy what ifs anymore, or because the bases are gone. So I'm pro housing, but it's cautiously optimistic, because we are buying, we are offering, but I'm nowhere near sellers' expectations, brokers' expectations. So I do think the market is strong, but I am not a believer in this massive rent growth story that you've seen. Every report comes out now, you still see, rent growth, double digits, high single digit. I own these deals. Our rent growth is there, but it's not nearly as strong as what these reports are. And I can tell you that the delinquencies are up. People are paying a little bit slower. And I'm cautiously optimistic, but, I'm not diving headfirst into the pool right now on multifamily or pre-existing assets, just because they're not penciling. And for me to buy that deal, it has to really cash flow, not broker pro forma cash flow or, optimistic sponsor cash flow. I know what these things actually cost to operate. Insurance, insurance is going crazy. Interest rates are going crazy. So we have to buy a deal that really generates a real cash flow, and it's just not happening. So we're still offering. We're still there. We want to be relevant. I don't see the value in buying a 1970s deal for virtually the price you could rebuild it for. So delicately, walking around that right now.
Yeah. And one of the things you kind of said in the beginning of the episode, where you're talking about investing in deals that really needed a lot more of an uplift, right? So there's, for those of you that are listening out there, when you think about like a value add strategy, right? It's kind of how we started this conversation. That's generally what we would consider like a stabilized property that really could use a facelift and some amenities, right? So there's tenants in there. It's already, cash flowing on its own, but there's an opportunity to bring it up to the market, and there's value, right? Then you take a step down and there's a little bit of distress, right? Which is a slightly different ballgame. John, is that where you guys were kind of playing, is really kind of a step down from like the true value add?
For sure. I mean, it would be opportunistic. But 340 unit vacant deal in Mobile, Alabama, the 50% occupied property in Jackson, Mississippi. So they were distressed deals. Just, I'm not saying it was really hard to default on properties over the last 10 years, but they were just no occupancy, horrible tenant base. We were coming in and basically re-tenanting, spending $25,000 a unit plus, not just going in and doing, stainless steel appliances and granite and raising rents a little bit. They were short of dilapidated, they were super heavy lift opportunistic deals. So definitely below that prototypical, what we've seen value add be over the last 5 years.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's super important, because if you think about the placement of a deal that you did a few years ago, right, if you're buying it with some distress and then you've got the equity, like there's a pretty significant, equity jump for you. Whereas what's really interesting about the market, and you can correct me if you see this differently, is that so office space used to be the darling of like big capital, right? Think institutional capital. That's where they put all their money. It was like 3, 5, 7 year leases. Like it was great. Then the pandemic hit. And then all of a sudden, they're seeing like, well, nobody's going to the office. So they started shifting into other asset classes. And multifamily was a huge beneficiary of this shift of money coming in. And honestly, like institutional capital, big investors do not want to do, and typically have not done, a lot of these real distress type deals. They let some developer or somebody else do it, and then they'll go buy it after it's done. And they'll take the lower risk and the lower cash flow, and that's the way they work. But what happened was that they had all this money that needed to go to work, and it shifted, and all of a sudden, it cascaded all the way down through the multifamily market. So like, yes, Class A is already booked up. Now, like for the first time, they're looking at Bs and Cs, and it's pushing everybody in the stack kind of a little bit further down. And therefore, like to your point, like you weren't in a situation where, deals were making sense, because like basically big money is kind of pushing down the stack, and like the prices were getting out of control, and like your ability to build that cushion into your deals is evaporated. Is that a fair statement?
No, that's spot on. I mean, we sold some of our deals to groups that would never, ever be operating in this space. And you know, when we were looking at those deals, it was simple, right? You have a 50% occupied property and the market is 90% occupied. You knew, and these units aren't just, they're rent ready and just not leased. They are down. So it was really easy for us to look at that deal and say, okay, well, if we put in 10 a door, 15 a door, 20 a door, and we just bring that unit back online and we get the lease that everyone's already paying, not projecting market growth, just by moving the occupancy, not even to 90. So, you know, some of the deals we underwrote were, you know, pro forma at 80%, 85% for the first 2 years. And it's like, you're obviously just going to add value. It costs you $20,000 to fix a unit, but at a 6 cap, 7 cap, 8 cap, whatever you want to use, 3 cap, like we've seen, you were just getting such a massive pop by filling up your property, let alone the value add component. And some of these deals you'd sell, you were just like, why would that group be interested in this? This is something that normally, you know, wouldn't go to that type of investor. But you're right. Yeah. It was so hard to chase these other deals, and the plateau changed so quickly that groups were all coming down, and it forced deal, you know, guys like us and other people into products that, you know, we bought very rough stuff. I didn't want to go to the lower, you know, one step down to achieve the same return. So we went the other way, which was, you know, all right, we'll sell it. We'll sell this and we'll just go find the other one. But where we struggled is that we were competing now in a space with groups that historically wouldn't be in there, and our returns weren't there. So we just saw that as, you know, I'm not going to push to make a lower amount of money on a heavy lifting project. But you're spot on. I mean, it just, you know, people were going into so much capital out there that the return just started getting compressed so tight that, you know, it was like a fix and flip at that point, where your margin of error was, you know, if you had to change the paint color, you made no money. And it's like, that's not worth the risk from our perspective.
Yeah. And I mean, the reason that's so important is we think about deals that have come through in the past, let's call it 2 or 3 years, with all this extra money kind of cascading down to the stack. There used to be discounts, right? As you go from A to B and B to C. And then those effectively disappeared, right? Because the money had to go to work. And then to your point, like, if you've got a stabilized property and you're already buying it at, you know, almost a 3 cap rate, or even, you know, some places like upper twos, like, there is zero margin for error. And then cash flow is out the window. And then, like, people had to do really interesting stuff with their debt. They're buying floating rate debt or the, you know, bridge loans that were going to expire to make it pencil. It worked at the time. But what we're seeing now in the marketplace, and the reason things are getting kind of squirrely, especially on deals, and like, actually do want to kind of take a little bit of a tangent here, is that your point at the beginning was spot on. The housing market fundamentals are still very strong. There is a shortage and people are looking for places to live. You know, people are still spending money. So it's out there. It's not that like the industry is bad and we overbuilt, you know, like we did in 2008. Like, we're behind. Right? There should be pressure on rent. Rent should be growing. But these, you know, with the debt rates going up so fast and all of these, you know, deals that were purchased at, you know, crazy low cap rates and basically free money, like, those things are starting to kick back in, and there was zero room for error. And, you know, prices for the, even these fix and flips, right? Where you're like painting something, it's like the cost of paint went up twice, right? Like sheetrock, you name it. Like, it really has gotten crazy. And what's happening now is that those deals that were done, you know, right before COVID or even the early phases of COVID are now coming into distress because the cash flow is not gone, right? Like, the bank rate is floated up or it's due and the banks are like, you know what? We don't want this anymore. Sorry. And if you read, and just kind of as a side, like, if you follow the headlines like I do, you'll actually see that the banks are now like taking a pause on lending, you know, in the multifamily space and the office space, because they're like, we just need to see what's about to happen. So what that does, it has this cascading, ratcheting up effect of like, all right, well, the banks that are lending at even higher interest rates, right? And like, the discount rate between, like, you know, the Fed rate and what they're lending at is growing because they're saying, hey, there's more risk and we're the only players in the game.
You're right. If I'm the only guy lending, I can dictate my terms. And so the spreads are now, it's a ripple effect. And these banks that made these loans, they made these loans at the time and now they're coming due. And these properties might be performing well, really good occupancy, but the DSCRs, and they're all off. So these banks are at this crossroad where they're like, yeah, you're not meeting any of the requirements in the loan documents and your property's not worth nearly, you know, what you thought it would be worth. You know, over leverage is probably the biggest mistake people made over the last couple of years. We saw it on deals we sold, you know, people's, you know, on the closing statement, I'm like, that's how much debt you're getting here. Okay. You know, I'll circle this one to come back to it in 12 months. And, you know, we were lucky enough to sell nearly everything over the last, two and a half years. But banks are in an awkward position now where they've made some loans that I think the banks will be fine, but the equity will be lost. Pref will take over equity. Cash flow is virtually non-existent. But it's going to be interesting because the fundamentals on housing are great. I don't think like the world's coming to an end and there's just going to be a million deals out there. You have the pick of the litter. I don't think that's going to happen, but there will be a resupply of property that sells at a discount because the banks are going to force some of these sales. So it's going to be interesting to see how that implicates cap rates and returns and who's buying these deals again and who's lending on these deals.
Yeah, and I'll just make one little final point that I've learned over time is that the banks seem like they're the bad guys, and to a certain degree, they kind of sort of can be. But a lot of what's happening is that it's driven by requirements, like it's regulatory requirements. Like, so, when the banks, they underwrite, they have all these, all the underwriting things, and there's these covenants in there, and they have to follow the covenants, and they can't have this many underperforming because then they have to write down the loan, which then impacts their balance sheet. And then when they take assets back, it's on their balance sheet. That's something that they can't have on their balance sheet. It's actually a liability. So like there are a lot of really weird things that the banks have to deal with that are going to force this issue. And it's not like they can just say, like, we think this is just a bump in time. Like, we'll just give everybody like a deep breath, like maybe some community banks and like some folks that are on balance sheeting, some of their portfolio can do that. But a lot of banks aren't going to be able to do that. And as a result, like it's going to force the spiral of downward valuations. And that's regulated, right? Like it's not the banks that are necessarily the bad guys, but like, they are now in trying to get as much risk out of their plate, as they can, and saying, we don't want to do any more of that, right? Let's figure out what we've got and we'll go from there. Well, John, let's pivot. Like now we're in a situation where deals are going sideways, right? Pref payments are gone, right? Now we're looking at, banks pushing on sponsors to come up with something else, which generally is going to require more equity, which probably means that we're talking about capital calls. Like some of the, like even with a capital call, it might not be fixable, right? Banks may still say they don't want to do it, but explain the typical mechanisms of like what happens when a property goes underwater, or like how do the operating agreements work? How does the partnership agreement work? What is the requirement to go into, to actually take a capital call, and what happens if you don't?
Yeah, so those are all things that I think sort of were getting pushed under the rug, and no one was really focusing on a lot of these deals that were done over the last 24 months in particular, where it was all clear sailing. But you got to remember that, if you have, we're lucky, we're a really well-capitalized group, and we're not the group that is doing 150 investors, right? Where we run a totally different model. We also put a ton of our own money into deals. But, the question I tell limited partners to always ask is, there's language in there, right? It's a section of the operating agreement that says what happens if you need money. And, there's either a dilution or people have to put it in. But if you go to 100 investors, 50 investors, 30, if they don't have the cash to physically put it in, the sponsor is in a position where they either have to, there's a mechanism in the operating agreement where they can go out and go get other money at market rate terms normally, or debt. But you're adding a debt load to that property that it may or may not be able to support in the future. So, a lot of people out there, we get, will you take a $5,000 investment? Absolutely not. No shot. But because if that's all you could put in today, even if you're accredited and you're qualified, if anything goes wrong in the future, you're going to be diluted down to virtually nothing, especially if everyone can't pull the money together to fix the problem. And like you said, there are situations I've seen them where banks are like, your loan's coming due. We'll give you an extension, but we want you to buy the loan down $4 million. It's like, okay, I need an extra $4 million. Not only that, but, I might need money for renovations, or I might have, I might come up short somewhere else. So your operating agreement is very important to understand what that trigger is, what that looks like. Is it an official capital call? Is there language that the sponsor has to formally put out there? What happens? What's the repercussion? How much time do you have to come up with that capital and what that looks like? And I think, being really well capitalized out of the box is important, but understanding that, these deals don't always work according to plan. And rob from Peter and pay Paul is not the right terminology. And I don't mean literally take it from somewhere and put it somewhere else. I'm talking about, you think you're spending $10,000 a door on a renovation and you end up spending 12, but now you don't do that parking lot, or maybe your roof was a little bit more expensive. So you're always moving capital around inside of the project, where, stainless steel appliances are, $2,500 bucks. Now they're $3,500. Okay, well, we can't do the, the lighting package that we wanted to. So you start moving money around within the physical operations of the deal. If you add another element in there, like a capital call, if people can't come up with the money, well, the money has to be come up from somewhere, whether it's the sponsor himself putting in the official capital call, whether you go out and you go get preferred equity, or whether you go out and get another instrument of debt. But you got to realize now you're subordinating. So you're going lower down the capital stack. So you have a first position debt, a potential a second position debt, or a capital call that's going to dilute everybody. You know, that money's going to come out first before the equity is recaptured. And obviously each document's written in a different way, but when you have pref equity in there from the beginning, it gets a little dicey. So it's just something that you really got to understand, because, you know, it's, do you want to put more money into this, or do I want to chalk it up as whatever happens and use your money in a better situation? And I'm not saying you want to throw good money after bad, but there is a situation that you have to evaluate where it's, you know, maybe it's better off doing nothing. And, you know, whatever you have in that deal, realizing that you could lose that. But, you know, you don't want to throw more money in. That's going to go away as well. So it's really compelling to see how this is going to affect certain deals out there that are not doing well, or sponsors that are scrambling to, you know, hopefully figure it out. These are evaluations that everybody's got to do on their own, and to see how they, you know, to see how they pencil and how it affects your, you know, your bottom line.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point too. And I think what's really important on along those lines as well is that you need to see that's actually how it's happening, right? Because in the event that, like, you know, people are like gunslinging and just trying to fix things, you basically have violated your operating agreement and created some other agreement, right? That's out there that now may or may not, you know, take over. And I think that those are the things that you've got to be really cautious of. So one, you know, like if you're in this position, right, I think I agree, you've got to evaluate whether or not you're going to throw money after. If you think it's, you know, good money after good and it's just a function of time and you can do it, sure. If you think it might be good money after bad, you might just be like, hey, we'll see if we get any of this back. But I would also recommend that you guys make, you know, see how they handle, you know, the situation. You know, does it seem like they're running around with their hair on fire and like the world's falling apart, or is it a very professional, like, this is the way the operating agreement lays it out, this is what's going to happen? Is it very, you know, calmly communicated to you? Because again, like, you need to make sure that it's processed exactly like the operating agreement says. Or, you know, even if it does resolve itself and work itself out, you may have some other like layer of investor in there that actually owns way more of it than you ever even thought.
So that's there's spot on, right? You know, it's a document and you got to follow it. And you want to see how the sponsor handles or the operator handles the situation. Because if it's, like you said, if it's a matter of time and it's just a little bit of a, you know, rocky road, but overall it's fine, you know, it's typically no harm, no foul. But if it's just, you know, mass mayhem, you really got to sit back. Because at the end of the day, you know, I say it all the time, you know, if someone can't do it, what are you going to get from them, right? So the penalty is really on the sponsor at the end of the day, and all the LP partners by their unable to commit. So it's a dicey situation, but you definitely have to understand it and understand these things. You know, it's like insurance, right? If you don't have it when you need it, that's the purpose of it. So you want to understand these things going in. Now, people that are already in, you know, you might want to get proactive, but you definitely want to understand it before you do it, so you know what the ramifications are if something goes a little sideways.
Yeah, and I think one other point that I'm going to highlight, and I've seen a lot of this in my career, is that there are folks out there, companies, organizations, entities that have been waiting for this moment, right? And they come riding in like the White Knight with capital, and they can solve it. But they are very good at what they do, and they end up owning a lot of stuff for peanuts, right? Pennies on the dollar, because they know how to do this, and they've been waiting for this moment. So I think that the other thing too is, like, when you're looking at these deals and you see that there's a potential capital call, or like there's somebody else riding in that's going to inject some equity into the deal, like, you better know before you put any more money in it, like, what are the terms of that? Because, you know, ultimately these guys that are injecting, you know, capital into a distressed situation, their real goal is either to have an extremely high return, but even better, own the asset, right? And like, that's the game. So watch out for that.
It really is. And it's, you know, a shame, because there's a whole part of the market and segment of the market that thrives in this position. And as the lowest level LP investor, if that situation occurs, you really want to understand the terms of that document, because they're not doing it out of the kindness of their heart. I can guarantee that. They're doing it with, you know, maybe it's an ulterior motive, or maybe it's because it's going to be a really good return. But those are all things that are going to significantly impact the final number from being a return to a complete loss or anywhere in between.
Yeah, John, I appreciate your insights on this, because it's such a crucial moment in time where my listeners are out there who are actually facing this, writing in, they're asking about it. But is there anything else, you know, that you think we need to convey to make this episode complete?
I think that the three things that we look at now that I think any limited partner should be looking at is the, you know, the terms of the debt and the leverage of the debt, and what are those triggers inside that debt clause? Because at the end of the day, when we've been buying a lot of land, we're doing it all cash. You know, we never were over leveraged on any deal we bought. And even, you know, over the last 10 years, I think our highest leverage deal might have been 65, maybe 70%. So we were always on the risk adverse side of that. And we've been looking at deals just all cash. At the end of the day, all cash, they can't take it away. As long as you pay your taxes and your insurance, you typically can weather the storm for the most part, right? Pending capital. But going into deals today, you really got to understand the debt terms and what are the triggers that arise if something goes sideways or something doesn't work. And those are the things that we are, you know, the capitalization of the entity buying the deal, not just, you know, the sponsor, but, you know, what is the capital plan here and how much, you know, what extra do we have? What extra don't we have? Because that's how you're going to ride out any potential storm that occurs. Now, what's been done, the glut, you know, the can't cry for spilt milk, but understanding those things going forward, I think is extremely important. And, you know, an absolute must before you go into any deal is just really what that debt situation looks like and making sure it's not over leveraged or disguised with preferred equity. Those are the things that, you know, we're, you know, overly clear on when we're going into a deal and we're talking to investors. But yeah, I mean, we get the pushback, you know, this return's not that high. It's like, well, there's no debt on it. Or it's 50% leverage, right? You know, it's a risk reward, right? And if it's worth the reward, then take the risk. But if not, then, you know, just, you know, sometimes the best thing you do is nothing at all.
Yeah. And I guess maybe one other thought is, you really talk about debt and the terms and what triggers it, is probably it would behoove you as an investor, if like you're in a situation where there is no cash flow, there are no pref payments, then you're in a situation where it's likely already starting to trigger some of those things at the bank that I talked about. And one of the things that is super critical is that, you know, there's a loan officer at the bank that's ultimately responsible for the loan that they help write. And then once it starts triggering things, if they have a proactive plan ahead of time and they're in real good communication with a lender and they feel like they can work something out, they can prevent things from happening too fast. However, if there's zero communication, it just gets lopped over the fence to the people that assume the worst. And the reason I'm telling you this is that if you're in a situation now where the pref payments aren't coming in, you're probably not meeting your DSCR requirements, meaning like there's not enough cash coming in, you're tripping some covenants, I would reach out and ask, are we talking to the bank already? Like, you know, are we having those conversations?
Spot on. Because when, you know, if you wait till the last minute, it's a lot harder than getting out ahead of it. Because once it gets to the last minute, it goes to the side of the business that they don't care, right? It's protecting themselves more so than anything else. So you want to be proactive for sure.
Well, John, this has been a great episode. I mean, I know it's been a little bit of doom and gloom, but I think that the opportunity is here. Like you said, that the prices are starting to reset, you know, and I think smart investors are going to make, you know, a killing in this coming market. But thank you for sharing your knowledge. I mean, I love your story, and thank you for being here.
No, Jake, I appreciate it. I mean, hopefully, you know, short of doom and gloom, you know, I do see the silver lining, and fundamentals are still there. You just got to be a little bit more careful. And I agree. I think that the smarter investor today will be set up significantly better than even the last 10 years, which have been the heyday.
That's right. Well, I like to end every episode with a little bit of gratitude, because I probably, like you, didn't get to where I am and or sit in the seat that I get to sit in without somebody giving me a leg up that I probably didn't deserve. So I want to give you an opportunity to maybe give a public shout out to somebody that you haven't done. Say thank you.
Yeah, no, I think overall, all of our investors, my partner, you know, everybody that's been able to provide what they provided for us. Yes, we've been able to provide really good deals, but without them throughout this entire process, them being, you know, every investor, my partner, you know, my partners on deals, we wouldn't have what we've had, and we wouldn't be, you know, as successful, quote unquote, whatever you see success as. I think every one of those people deserves, you know, the utmost confidence in us. And then I couldn't be more appreciative for them.
I agree. That's awesome. You know, when somebody hands you their money, like, that is the ultimate sign of trust. And I mean, I know that when it's happened for me, it's kind of nerve wracking because I could take it really personally. So to all the investors out there for Toro, you guys, John appreciates it. Well, John, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and I'd actually love for you to contribute to a future episode. If you have a question you'd like answered, or a topic or a guest to bring on the show, please email me at jake@thelimitedpartner.com. Now, I realize there's a lot of lingo that's thrown around on these shows, so I've created a cheat sheet for you with the top 26 terms that come up most often. Head on over to thelimitedpartner.com/lingo for the list. Enjoy, and we'll see you next time.